Hello, and welcome to the Texas Tribune TripCast. This is former Secretary of Education, Margaret Spellings. I'm checking in to make sure no one's being left behind. And now I'd like to introduce this week's TripCast team.
Thank you, Secretary Spellings. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the TripCast for the second week of November. Joining me is Executive Editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Reporter Brandy Grissom.
Hello.
And reporter Jay Root.
The golden voice.
That's it. That's why we have you on. And of course, we were not expecting to have Brandy on this week, so I want to start with her because she was going to be off covering an execution.
That's right.
And so we're going to talk about that case and other cases that have made news in the criminal justice arena this week, and then we're also going to get into the presidential campaign, as we often do, and then redistricting and the state races as well. So, Brandy, Hank Skinner was going to be executed today, right, and you were going to be there, but what happened with that? Maybe we'll start there.
Well, the Court of Criminal Appeals issued a stay in Skinner's case on Monday. The deal with Skinner is that he's been seeking DNA testing for about 10 years in his case. It's one of the longest cases that folks in that arena sort of know about, where someone has been seeking DNA testing for so long and so unsuccessfully. Hank Skinner was convicted in 1995 of killing his live-in girlfriend and her two sons. And he claims that there's all this DNA evidence that hasn't been tested that could prove that he's innocent. He has alleged that his girlfriend's uncle, who was sort of a notoriously bad kind of guy, was actually the one who did the killings. But I think the trouble for Skinner that he's going to face going forward in dealing with the Court of Criminal Appeals is they've already denied his request twice for DNA testing. And the reason that they've denied it is not only the state law, which has changed in his favor now, but they've also denied it because they say he can't prove, no matter what the DNA results are, that he wasn't there, that he didn't commit this crime. And Skinner admits as much. He was there the night of the killings, but he says that he was, you know, so comatose from this cocktail of vodka and codeine, because it was New Year's Eve, of course, that he couldn't have physically done this crime. And so he says this DNA evidence will put somebody else there, but he, no matter what the DNA evidence comes back with, it'll be a trouble for him to prove that he wasn't there. And that's what the court has decided in these past two occasions when they've denied his tests.
So he can answer the first question, somebody else was there, but he can't answer the second question, and therefore it wasn't me.
Right. That's the trouble he has.
So then what are we waiting for? Why give him the stay?
Well, the reason that the court issued the stay is because this past year in the legislative session, lawmakers expanded the post-conviction DNA testing law. And one of the things that they did was repeal the provisions that the court had used previous times to deny his case, to deny his requests. And so the court said, based on the change in the law, we're going to take another look at this case. But I think they're still going to have that same stumbling block of him being there.
What's the timeline now?
They didn't set a deadline. They just said pending their decision. So mm-hmm. I suppose they'll take some time to look at it, review it, and come back.
But he's not off the hook.
Not at all.
And Dwayne Buck is another high-profile case that is very much not off the hook.
Yeah. Right. That's sort of an interesting one where the psychologist who testified at his trial said that race was a factor in determining whether or not he would be a future danger to society. This same psychologist, Dr. Quijano, testified in a number of other cases, and Senator Cornyn, who was then the attorney general, admitted in court documents that testimony was unfair to these defendants who had all received the death penalty, and that Cornyn wouldn't oppose their retrials, but Buck never had a retrial for, you know, some procedural reasons. And so that's what his attorneys are saying, is that he should have a retrial, at least on the sentencing portion of his case. But the Supreme Court, after staying his previous execution, came back this week and said that he didn't deserve to have a retrial, because what happened in his case was that his own lawyers were the ones who brought forward the testimony from Dr. Quijano about race. And so they said,
what kind of lawyers are those?
Well, they Dr. Quijano actually said in his testimony that Buck wouldn't be a future danger to society. But when he was describing factors that lead to those types of conclusions, he described race as one of those factors. And so in their dissent, Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan said, you know, the fact that this was brought up at all and that prosecutors did mention it again should mean that he gets a retrial. But the majority opinion said no.
But it's not as simple as the guy came out and testified saying that he would do this again because of his race.
No, it's not that straightforward at all. And Buck's lawyers are asking the district attorney in Harris County, Judge Lykos, to intervene and step down and you know, postpone his execution date to give him a chance for another trial. My past conversations with that office, they've not indicated any likeliness to do that.
What's the date that's set now?
I don't think they have one set right now.
Okay. Any other cases that have been catching your eye on this very busy week?
Well, the Morton case ongoing is... that's, to me, one of the most incredible, important cases going on in Texas right now. And so...
this is the Williamson County case.
Right, where Michael Morton was convicted of murder in 1987. DNA proved that he didn't commit that murder, that another man did, a man who they have not yet arrested, despite having his DNA and his connection to yet another murder that happened here in Travis County. So we're waiting for him to be arrested. We're waiting to find out what will happen with this ongoing investigation into whether or not Williamson County officials intentionally suppressed evidence that led to his wrongful conviction. There were testimony. There was a transcript of a conversation with Morton's mother-in-law, who said that Morton's three-year-old son had described the murder scene to her, described what happened in the murder, and that Michael Morton wasn't the guy there. It wasn't his daddy who did this crime. There were also checks and credit cards of Christine Morton's that were used in San Antonio after her death, and some neighbors who described seeing some very suspicious situations going on in the neighborhood. And none of those items came forth at Morton's original trial.
This is all stuff the prosecution supposedly knew about but didn't pass on to the defense.
Right. And so now, you know, Morton's attorneys are trying to get to the bottom of how this could have happened, who was responsible for this wrongful conviction. And so far, they've deposed an investigator and an assistant district attorney, and those fingers seem to be pointing at Ken Anderson, who was at the time the district attorney and who is now a state district judge appointed by Governor Perry.
Does any of this rub off on Perry? This seems to be this sort of a week of, you know, cases that make the court system in the state seem a bit tenuous.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's sort of this. I mean, that's kind of an interesting question. In a Republican primary, does it matter, you know, that the death penalty might, you know, not be prosecuted correctly in your state? I mean, how does this play out? Is this coming up at all?
No, I don't think it will. I think that you obviously it's bad to have innocent people or people who, you know, where there are doubts about their guilt, arrested, jailed, you know, prosecuted, whatever. But until you have, I remember the Carla Faye Tucker case sort of broke through
when George Bush was running,
right? And that was, you know, I mean, she ended up getting executed, but it did break through. I mean, Pat Robertson talked about it. I haven't seen any evidence that any case from Texas. I mean, Cameron Todd Willingham has broken through a little bit, but it's mainly like, you know, the LA Times writes about mm-hmm. it, and there a few journalists have made it a big deal, but it doesn't. It's not really a factor on the campaign trail. Never hear about it. You know, when it may have come up in one debate, I can't even remember. It's not a factor.
Are you hearing the lawyers, Brandy, when they're talking about these cases? Is there any political topspin on anything?
I mean, I think the biggest political fallout is probably going to be, well, potentially for Ken Anderson, but also for John Bradley, the current district attorney in Williamson County. I'm already hearing, well, we've already seen actually one lawyer from that area who said he's going to run against Bradley. And, you know, Bradley's role here is not small. He objected to DNA testing on the evidence that proved Morton's innocence for 6 years, and also objected to revealing some of the documents in the file that showed that, you know, that prosecutors had all of this exculpatory information about Morton at the time of the trial.
And this is the same John Bradley that famously delayed the Cameron Todd Willingham investigation
by the Forensic Science Commission.
Quite some time.
Right. I mean, if you want to, I mean, if somebody, that's why I'm asking, I mean, if somebody was inclined, you know, this is the guy that Rick Perry put in charge of the Forensic Science Commission that looked at the Cameron Todd Willingham case.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that it shouldn't be.
I'm just asking.
Examined.
If it is.
Yeah, I right. think. That, I mean, I think it's certainly legitimate, and there are tons of issues. I mean, like for example, the uninsured in Texas. That's been another issue that just hasn't really caught fire.
Mm-hmm.
And it should probably be a very large issue since we have 25%, you know, uninsured here. But
well, Perry did just totally sidestep that in one debate
right.
when he was asked about it directly.
Right. But you know, it just has not really broken through. And I think that the main reason is because the other candidates don't want to touch anything that in any way would have them be characterized as anything but, you know, hang them from the highest tree.
Not a primary issue, maybe, but maybe a general?
Even then, I mean, you know, Democrats typically don't want to be. I mean, when's the last time that the death penalty has, you know, of being in any way trying to curb the death penalty, when has that been a good political issue for anybody? Mm-hmm. I know in Illinois, obviously, they had a moratorium, and
That governor went to jail.
Right, that governor ended up going to jail for something unrelated. But it's just, I, you know, the last time I remember a death penalty issue breaking through in a presidential race was when in 1990, late 91 or early 92, Bill Clinton left the campaign trail to go home and preside over the execution of somebody who was believed to be mentally retarded.
Right.
So, or maybe retarded is not the proper term, mentally incapacitated or whatever, that he was not all there.
I'm not sure it's just the death penalty, though. Was Morton a death penalty case?
No, Morton.
He was just in jail for a quarter of a century or something.
No, in fact, Morton, you know, one of Morton's lines in this was, I sure am glad that wasn't a death penalty case because I wouldn't be here to argue it now.
It's not necessarily death penalty. I mean, I think everyone can get behind a legal system that works, you know.
Well, I mean, Jay may be right. I mean, you know, this comes up from time to time, but, you know, it's sort of a non-starter politically unless you get a situation where, I guess, like we haven't seen yet, because you know none of these cases has really caught political fire.
Well, I just kind of wonder what is.
Like, I think so, you know, the ones that I think have been really good issues is when somebody has gotten completely railroaded and it's obvious, like Timothy Cole, where he died in prison and was accused of a rape that he didn't commit. I think Skinner is an example of something where. Not Skinner, Morton.
Right.
Morton is an example of something that, like, look, the DNA evidence shows that he didn't do this. What you haven't had is somebody like that actually either get executed or get really, really close to execution. I mean, we haven't seen that in modern times. And somebody that's really, and I know this is sort of, in a way, a terrible thing, but a really sympathetic character. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the problems with Cameron Todd Willingham was, like, Rick Perry was sort of on safe ground when he said, you know, he's a monster, because there was testimony that he had done a lot of bad things or whatever. Not that that means that you should be executed for something you didn't do. Of course you shouldn't. But because there was sort of this mitigating information about him personally, people just didn't really. He never became a proper poster child for the anti-death penalty movement,
right,
because it was like there were too many people that were able to say, you know, he's not a sympathetic character. And unfair, but that's the way it works.
I don't know, if you look at Anthony Graves, he was on death row, and he'd never committed a crime before he was sentenced to be executed. He's an incredibly sympathetic kind of character.
Yeah,
had, you know, he did well in school and was, you know, by all accounts, a nice guy. Still is. And yet his case hasn't seemed to rise to that level either. So, I mean, I just wonder, when does it become a political issue?
Well, and it may not. I mean, the death penalty remains very popular. We just did some polling on it. The death penalty is very popular. And the question that we followed that with, I don't have the numbers in front of me, was do you think that the death penalty is always prosecuted without mistake. I can't remember the phrasing of the question. And most people didn't say never. The abundance of votes were in, it's almost never done with mistakes, or it's occasionally done with mistakes, but they continue to support it. It's not an issue that moves voters, or apparently isn't an issue that moves voters.
And it also makes for a very somber opening to the TribCast. So thank you, Brandy, for walking us through that.
Always glad to help.
Yeah, and now we need to move on to the campaign trail. Speaking of legal trouble, I guess we'll dive into what's been going on with Herman Cain, since he's been in the news more than the Texas governor. I went down to the Woodlands and saw Cain and Gingrich theoretically do a debate.
Sing kumbaya, right?
It wasn't much of a debate. Even afterwards, Gingrich said, it's wrong to call this a debate. It's more of a dialogue. They basically sat around and talked about entitlements and how all entitlement programs should be changed. And they all agreed. It was really sort of a brilliant move on Gingrich's part, because he looked like a genius. I mean, he just sat there.
He was in his element. Know,
saying everything that he doesn't have time to say at a normal debate, and then Cain would agree.
What was the audience?
The audience was people from the Woodlands. It was put on by a Tea Party group. But the big news that came out of it was when afterwards a reporter tried to ask Cain about all the sexual harassment allegations that at the time there were only a couple of accusers. Now, by the time you hear this TribCast, you know, who knows how many they will be.
We're at four at this point, I think.
Or five, actually.
Five, is that right?
Yeah, five.
Yeah. This is being recorded on Wednesday morning.
How'd that go when the reporter asked that?
Cain told him to be quiet and then asked his chief of staff, Mark Block, a famous cigarette addict, to provide the reporter with the journalistic code of ethics, which has created a bunch of jokes among the journalistic Twitterati, I guess. But then it all blew up. And the organizers, the one thing that really interested me, and Ross, you wrote about this a little bit, was that the organizers of the event, who are not on the campaign staff, but are just the part of the Texas Patriots pack that put it on, started yelling, "No gossip, no gossip, no gossip." And before the actual event, they had actually, at every seat that the reporter were going to be at, they put down a letter that said, well, I'll read you a small clip of it. It said, "You are journalists. You know what we are saying. We respectfully request that you honor the finest tradition of this profession and focus and report on reality, not gossip. This is an amazing opportunity for the American people to change how they decide whom to vote for." It just struck me as odd that, you know, there's been this whole thing about, oh, these are anonymous accusations, blah, blah, blah. But right. There are documented settlements
around
harassment allegations.
There's not gossip. Here. Yeah, there's a difference here between gossip and news. I mean, you know, we hear all kinds of stuff like everybody does. And our job is to, you know, confirm what we can confirm and write about the things that we can write about, you know, that sort of meet some basic standard of substantiation. And the initial report on this, I think Politico worked on it gave him 10 days notice or something like that. The initial report on this was that there had been two sexual harassment claims filed against Herman Cain when he was at the National Restaurant Association that had resulted in settlements to the women who filed the complaints. That's all true. There were allegations that there were more people there. And, you know, I don't work at Politico. I don't know what they had there. But, you know, obviously some more people have come forward. This, help me with the name, Sharon
Bialik.
Yeah,
Bialik.
That was Gloria Allred's
right.
Client, and she came forward. And
there's two
and
things
they've named
here.
Another woman, the Daily. Actually
yeah, actually, by
woman.
The time people hear this, our tens of listeners out there.
I think we're up to a dozen.
Okay.
There's talk now.
Of a press conference that the... several of the women are going to get together allegedly and have this press conference. You know what I find? This the periphery of this story and the media criticism of this story has really been ridiculous and absurd. The idea that Politico or other news organizations that have reported on the facts of this should be on the defensive is ridiculous, number one, because what's been alleged here is that, you know, potentially something criminal or certainly a civil matter has occurred, civil harassment. Right. And so that's a the spotlight of being the front runner, which Herman Cain has been in and out of, is white hot. And when you get in it, I mean, this kind of stuff's going to come out.
Right.
And then the idea, you wrote about this very eloquently, the idea that if some campaign passed it along, like if the Rick Perry campaign passed along, we have no evidence that they did, not a shred, even though Herman Cain accused him of that. But even if they did,
they did have
call
method,
a reporter,
motive, and opportunity. But you know, it almost doesn't matter.
If they did, it would be sort of an advisable move.
And if you didn't, it's almost like political malpractice. I mean, I remember like that Karl Rove was blamed for sliming Lena Guerrero for, you know,
for saying she didn't, saying she did have a degree she never earned.
Yeah, and she's the one who did that to herself. Right. I mean, and Herman Cain is the one who's got to, I mean, and his answers to this, he went out the very first day when this came out. He was at the National Press Club, I believe is where it was. And he said, I don't know anything about this. And Then, you know, as the day goes on, like, well, actually, he did know about it. And he's given a series of conflicting accounts about what happened. And I don't see how he even remotely survives this. I mean, there's just so many women who were saying very, very similar things, and his answers have really been inadequate. And his defensiveness and the idea that he, for some reason, he gets a pass and doesn't have to answer this, I'm baffled.
And I just think that campaign has just lost so much credibility. They've made missteps where they don't even need to. Like yesterday, Mark Block coming out and saying that the second named accuser's son works at Politico, when Really there's a National Journal reporter with the same last name who doesn't work at Politico.
It turned out he doesn't work at Politico, and he's not related. So it's like, so there's two issues here. That, you know, I mean, the media is going to take shots here, and in some places it should. You know, that's part of the act. That's okay. That's political journalism. That's how it works. But there's two things here. One thing is, is it fair to bring forward everything about a candidate who you're electing to the top position in American politics that's going to tell you something about how they conduct themselves in office? If this guy was in a position of authority and was harassing women who worked for him, that's an abuse of power in a way. There were documented cases of this, and you put it there and you let the voters decide. I mean, they may say, okay, we're cool with that. They may say, this is horrendous, we're not going to vote for this guy. But you put all of those things forward. And part of the job of a political candidate is to build himself or herself up while pulling the opposition down. Every one of them is behaving like you would expect them to behave. It may have been Rick Perry. It may have been Newt Gingrich. It may have been Rick Santorum. I don't know.
It sounds like it was pretty widely disseminated without anybody spreading it.
About one of your opponents and you don't use it, I mean, it's to what you said. It's like it's a form of malpractice. The second thing here is, you know, there's this criticism of, you know, how the media is covering this, and maybe some of that's proper, but it doesn't take away from the fact that this is a factual piece of information about a candidate for the president of the United States.
How did they think this wouldn't come up, or how is this a surprise? Like, what? Why are they seemingly unprepared to deal with it?
I mean, the unbridled hubris of candidates who think that they are not going to be examined under the white hot spotlight of being a political front runner is, again, amazing.
And it happens at every level. What was the Joe Driver quote when you initially reported on him reimbursing himself out of his campaign and out of the state coffer? What was the Pretty well did. But you know, it's like he just never thought this was going to come up.
I guess not. Which I guess if you want to talk a little bit about Joe Driver,
it just happens all the time. It's just an example.
Well, with Cain in a previous race, he did warn his staff that this could come up and they had to get ready for it. And then, but he forgot about it for this race, I guess.
Well, he also said that somebody who has now joined the Perry campaign, Kurt Anderson worked for Herman Cain when he ran for the U.S. Senate in Georgia, and he said that as part of his alleged proof that the Perry campaign had leaked this, he said that Kurt Anderson was one of the only people who knew about it. And, you know, underscoring sort of his ever-changing answers, Cain later said, I'm almost certain that he knew. Well, so it's like, yeah, almost certain it just doesn't cut it.
And before he remembered telling Kurt Anderson that in 2004, he said he had said about all of this, I don't remember any of it. The story's just been all over the place. And really the central question here, I mean, it's interesting how it's unfolded and the procedural stuff about, you know, who leaked it and who did the press stuff and all of that is fascinating and interesting, and I read those stories too. But really the central thing here is this guy qualified to be president? Let's look at all of the everything we know about him, including how he reacts to crisis.
Here's what I wonder. How much does all of this crisis around Kane help Governor Perry?
I think that this is the window of opportunity that Perry needs to get his campaign back on track. There's a debate tonight. There's a debate on Saturday. There's endless debates, which, ironically, and you know how I feel about irony, debates, I love it, but debates...
If you don't know, he loves it. Yeah,
debates are sort of what did him in, and now, I mean, he's looking to debates to hopefully, you know, for him, pull him back out. I think that, I mean, Kane was strong in Iowa. I spent last week, all of last week, actually, in Iowa. I'm a little Iowa'd out. But I was amazed at how much people were willing to give Herman Kane slack. He was just an extremely popular figure there because he's not a politician, so to speak. But he has sounded a lot more like a politician in his answers. So I'm guessing that he is going to fall significantly. And now, can Perry or perhaps Gingrich...
Right. Can Perry squeeze through that window of opportunity if Gingrich is blocking it?
Well, you got to leave open the possibility that voters will look at all this stuff on Herman Kane and say it doesn't matter.
I think you could say that before, when you didn't have any women coming forward. I think as women come forward and you actually have names to and faces, it becomes more difficult for him. Mm-hmm. But we mentioned Joe Driver, if you want to do the elevator pitch about what's going on with Joe Driver.
Yeah, well, Representative Joe Driver, a year ago, I had this story after doing sort of an investigation of his spending practices, where I discovered basically that he was going on these trips and paying for the trips out of his campaign, and then he would come back to Texas and go to the Texas House of Representatives travel office and submit the exact same receipts for the exact same flights, the exact same luxury hotels, and fees for going to the ALEC or NCSL conferences, and then he would submit those to the state, and then he would just keep the money that he got from the state. So it was basically sort of a classic double-dipping case. Joe, if you're out there somewhere, I just want to tell you that I really appreciated your candor when I called, and I got a pretty good interview from Joe, and he basically acknowledged that he had been doing this for years, and he didn't think there was anything wrong with it, and, you know, when confronted, he fessed up to it. And now the Travis County Public Integrity Unit, the head of that unit, Greg Cox, confirmed to me last night, and we have that on the pages of the Texas Tribune, that Joe Driver is going to plead guilty to a third-degree felony. It's 2 to 10. He is eligible for probation for as little as 2 years, up to 10 years. Possibly could serve some time. We don't know yet because I haven't talked to the sentencing people, but possible that he would just get 2 years probation and a fine of up to $10,000.
And so he will not be involved in the next state elections.
Right.
Which is our transition over to redistricting,
which are in disarray at the moment. I mean, so we had these two courts working on this. That's the shortest way to say this. There's a court in the Washington, D.C., three federal judges working on redistricting and basically deciding the question of whether the new maps drawn by the Texas legislature give minorities fewer opportunities than they currently have to elect the candidates of their choice. Meanwhile, in San Antonio, a separate three-judge panel is deciding whether the growth in the state's population over the last 10 years, 89% of which was minority growth, is reflected in the new maps that were drawn. In other words, did minorities not only go backwards, as Washington is looking at, but were new seats drawn to reflect that growth in the population? And the Washington court said, we can't issue a summary judgment that the state asked for. And because of the place where we are on the timeline, we don't have time to hold a trial and determine whether these maps are good before the election season starts. So we're basically giving the starting gun for the San Antonio judges to draw court redistricting maps for the Texas House, the Texas Senate, and the Texas Congressional delegation that'll be used for the primaries. So San Antonio has its crayons out. They're drawing new maps for those. The legislatively
are you sliding San Antonio?
No.
They can use pens?
They're making maps. So the there's sort of an interesting thing there. The technicians who draw the maps at the Texas Legislative Council for the legislature have basically been impounded by the court, and say the court walks in and says, "We're taking over this joint. You're drawing for us now." So the same people who drew the state maps are now drawing for the judges.
So are all the races that we were prepared to watch, like Castro v. Doggett, et cetera, are those just all out the window now?
Not necessarily, but they could be. I mean, you don't know exactly what the courts are going to redraw. And, the courts basically said what the Washington court said in saying that they needed to hold a trial was that the state used improper methodology for figuring out where the minorities were properly protected in the new maps.
Is it fair to say that the Republican leaders in Texas lost this? I mean, they lost round one on this, right? I mean, this is a win for Democrats, right?
Right, because, the maps the legislature drew were Republican maps, and the Democrats were fighting them in court, that every single one of the people who filed suit, there's a list, there's a laundry list of lawyers and groups, were basically saying these maps are, most of them were saying these maps don't fairly reflect minority representation. But, the subtext of that is that minorities in Texas tend to vote for Democrats. So there was a partisan edge to this. And in fact, one of the reasons that the Republicans drew the maps the way that they did was to maximize Republican advantages on the maps. You try to institutionalize the wins that you got in the last election, and if those maps had held, they would get that. So, but what you don't know when the court starts redrawing this is, do they do tinkering and get the maps just where they want them, or do they start redrawing wholesale, and so every district's going to be different? And there are different theories out there. We'll know in a week or two.
Didn't we know during the legislative session that the courts were probably going to end up drawing the maps? I mean, did the Republicans, didn't they sort of expect that this would happen?
They didn't expect a wholesale redrawing of the maps. They expected some tinkering. You move a precinct line here, you move a voter there, they always do a little bit. And historically, the courts in redistricting cases, when they can, do as little drawing as they can to make the maps legal. So first you got to find out something's illegal, and then you say, well, if we change this little line over here, a nip and a tuck, then we can put this map back together. And I think the Republicans were hoping that if there was any change to the map, that it would be small like that. This opens the possibility that they're going to start all over again and redraw the maps wholesale, and that the legislature and the attorney general who was defending the legislature kind of gave up the Republican advantage here.
So there are probably a lot of would-be candidates with some questions out there.
There's a ton of them. Yeah.
And we should probably turn this over to Secretary Spellings to tell them what they can do with those.
If you have questions or comments about the TribCast, you can email tribcast@texastribune.org.
Thank you. On behalf of Ross, Brandy, Jay, and our producer Todd, who I hope will play a little bit of that Alanis Morissette song in Jay's honor as we roll out. This is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Isn't it ironic? Don't you think? It's like rain on your wedding day. It's a free ride on your morning day.
I can barely keep track of just one expense report.